Well, it's after 3 o'clock, and we will open the House Committee on Health Care for May 9, 2011. As our first order of business, which is always our first order of business, we change the agenda from what was printed. So we will not be working Senate Bill 94 today. We're missing paperwork. So those of you who are excited about that bill, we will give you additional information as it becomes available.
Hold it over till Monday, till Wednesday?
Yeah, let's... Yeah.
No, next week.
Next week?
All right.
When do you show the paperwork?
I don't know when the school will get me.
Well, why don't we hold it over until Wednesday and we can see Wednesday and we hold it again.
So you want to carry it over because we're under our posting deadline?
Yeah, if you carry it over, so
you'll have to announce that you're carrying 94 over to Wednesday.
Okay, we will carry Senate Bill 94 over to Wednesday, assuming we have the paperwork then. You know, it's that time of the session, ladies and gentlemen. Just keep us posted and we'll do the same for you. So today we're going to start then with a public hearing on Senate Bill 91. If I open a public hearing for Senate Bill 91.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 91A comes to you from the Senate floor with 26 ayes, 3 noes. It requires a health insurance carrier to offer, in addition, in each individual and small group market in which a carrier offers a health benefit plan, to provide a bronze and a silver plan coverage. It also specifies requirements for a catastrophic plan, specifies the operative date of January 2nd, 2014.
Okay, and first up we have Rocky King and Anthony Behrens. And you both know the drill, so I don't have to go through that.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the Interim Director of Healthcare Programs for the Oregon Health Authority, and with me today is Anthony Behrens, who is the Senior Policy Analyst on Health with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm assuming, Mr. Co-Chair, that you would like a shorter version rather than a longer version, but I will be prepared to answer any questions that you may have. Let me step back 20 years ago, 1991, the legislature established a requirement that all carriers in this state offer what's called the CHI, or basic plan, small employer health insurance plan, on a guaranteed issue basis. So they wanted to make sure that every carrier in the state had at least one plan that was cookie cutter, that people could compare the prices and deliver the provider networks from one carrier to another. The second purpose, though, of having that plan, in addition to providing comparison and guaranteed issue, was to provide one plan that became kind of the actuarial base upon which all other plans are somewhat priced. So once you looked at the price, similar benefits across all the different carriers for that one plan, the same relative prices for other plans offered by those carriers should remain constant, given benefit differentials between one plan or another. So here we had this plan offered by everybody, the same plan, good comparison from one individual to another when they wanted to see what the plans cost, but secondly, it provided the regulators with really a base upon which to judge the prices of other plans relative to that particular plan. Skipping forward now to 2014, we have a different market, a reformed market brought on by the Accountable Care Act that does a couple things. First of all, it is going to set a minimum standard that under the individual mandate that everybody who is required to, there are some exceptions, must purchase that minimum level of coverage. That's generally referred to as the bronze plan, which is equal to 60% of the value of an essential benefit package that the Department of Human Services, or HHS, excuse me, Human Health Services, is going to actually create over the next couple years. You've heard the metal plans. There's the bronze plan at 60%, the silver plan at 70%, gold plan at 80%, and the platinum at 90%. Within the exchange, if that passes and goes forward, whether it's a federal exchange or a state exchange, that bronze level of coverage becomes basically the minimum level of coverage that can be offered and still meet the federal mandate requirements.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
That's a question just to go back. I hear you saying that they're going to develop an essential benefit package, which somebody would assume is the essential benefit package, and then none of the four plans will meet that package? Is that...
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Representative Co-Chair Greenlit, that is correct. The essential benefit package is the list of all the services that will be required under the Accountable Care Act. The levels of coverage, the bronze through the platinum, really relate to cost sharing relative to those plans.
I see.
Okay, so the bronze plan
will all be there. It'll be 100%, but there'll be different kinds of cost sharing arrangements to get to that.
Correct. And so you could have the benefit package for the bronze plan will basically have the same benefits but just different cost sharing than, for example, the gold plan. Now, when we say cost sharing, though, understand that there could be 500 different cost sharing permutations to a particular plan. There are different ways to do it. $10 copay, $5 copay, more out of pocket. So they won't all be cookie cutter, but they'll be actuarially at those levels. So what this bill basically does is say we're in a new world. The basic CHI plan, Small Employer Health Insurance Plan, kind of goes away. And starting in January of 2014, we're going to require all carriers that operate in the individual and small group market to at least offer the basic bronze plan and, secondly, the silver plan. So whether you're in the exchange, whether you're outside the exchange, whether you're in both markets, you'll be required in the individual and small group market to offer these two plans. The bronze plan, similar to the basic plan from 1991, will be defined by DCBS through the rulemaking process, probably pull a whole bunch of people together to figure this out, but it will be a cookie-cutter plan so that every carrier will have that same plan. You can bring up on a spreadsheet, whether it's internet or sitting down with an agent or talking to a company, you'll be able to look at one company's bronze plan against another, same benefits, same cost sharing, and be able to compare those plans on the basis of price, provider networks, whatever that may be. The silver plan then is the next level up, and this would require not a specific silver plan, but it would require that every carrier offer at least one silver plan in each market in which they participate. Now, the reason for this really relates to adverse selection. What we want to make sure is that a carrier, either in the exchange or outside the exchange, doesn't come in and offer plans just in order to cream or cherry pick a particular market. So by requiring the carriers provide both of these levels of coverage, no matter what market they participate in, it reduces the risk of some of the adverse selection that will occur when we implement the federal reforms in January of 2014. The second thing that this 91A does is say that under federal law, we're able to offer a catastrophic plan. And that catastrophic plan will be a low-cost, less benefit plan that primarily is designed for individuals below the age of 29 or 30 below the age of 30. So that recognition that the young and the healthy don't need quite that bronze or silver or platinum level of coverage. So there's a catastrophic plan that will be a less coverage, and they can purchase that and meet whatever federal requirements are related to the mandate. There's also a group of individuals above the age of 30 that for income reasons may not meet the federal mandate requirement, and they will be eligible to participate. Now, this bill establishes that catastrophic plan will be only offered in the exchange. So that in order to offer that, a carrier would need to participate in the exchange. And there are two reasons for this. One is we wanted to prevent a company coming in and just offering that catastrophic coverage outside of the exchange and getting all of the healthy risks. The second reason is just as an incentive to help hopefully move more carriers into the exchange and give them a reason to participate. And one of those reasons is you'll have access to being able to offer this catastrophic plan. All of these are really a kind of a precursor to addressing some of the adverse selection that is going to occur in the market when we implement all the reforms, federal reforms, in January of 2014. It's not the only one. The federal government has three additional mechanisms and strategies to address some of the selection issues. But this one will, I think, at least from the onset, be able to equalize, I think, some of the plans that are offered throughout the market. That's a quick overview of this bill. There are some differences. You could say we want everybody to offer all four metal plans, or you could say one metal plan. And kind of the compromise as we developed this was to have both the bronze and the silver plan. I think it's a good bill, and it will give us some stability when the market reforms take place in January of 2014. With that, I will turn over to Anthony if he has anything to add.
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlink, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm with the Department of Consumer Business Services, the Insurance Division. And Rocky, as he did on the Senate side, did a wonderful job, a masterful job. And I don't really have anything to add, but I am here to answer any questions if I can.
Okay, so am I to assume correctly then that if the challenge to the federal insurance mandate is successful, the mandate would not apply here as well?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe that would be correct.
Unless we pass a separate bill to do it.
Unless we pass additional legislation, right.
Yep.
But we have no state mandate.
That would be correct.
So the mandate you referred to would be the federal mandate that maybe, who knows what's going to happen there.
Mr. Co-Chair, that would be correct.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair. Rocky, why... I'm just not understanding something. Why is the requirement imposed for the bronze and silver level, not the gold platinum? What's the risk that's trying to be adjusted for?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Cannon. First of all, let me talk about the bronze. The bronze was kind of picked as the base plan initially, and that's because that is the lowest level, and we wanted to make sure everybody was the same at that lowest level, that there wouldn't be any question that somebody had a plan out there that didn't necessarily meet a federal mandate if it continues to be enforced. The silver plan was important because in the exchange, when people get a subsidy, the subsidy applies to the purchase of the silver plan. So of the 375,000 people they project in the first 2 years of the exchange, the majority of those will have a federal subsidy through the tax credit system. Those people will be purchasing the silver plan. That's what the subsidy applies to. We chose the silver plan so that if somebody ported out of a subsidy, they started earning too much money, okay, that they could then move out of the exchange if they so chose, and that same silver plan offered by that carrier would be available to them. So it's kind of porting in and out of the exchange. You wanted to make sure that those folks had the same coverage available to them, whether they were in the exchange or out of the exchange or moving between. There are those that I will say that could argue that we should have the gold and platinum too. We thought that requiring that both inside and outside the exchange may prevent some carriers who did not want to offer a gold plan from participating in Oregon's market going forward. I should also add that the exchange under federal law has two plans that they're required to offer. One is a silver and one is a gold. So for those carriers operating in the exchange, there would be three plans that they, by federal law and state law, would have to offer: the bronze, silver, gold. Those outside of the exchange would be limited to the bronze and the silver. They could provide the gold, but it would be on their own. Does that answer your question? I'm hoping.
Yeah, I would have thought that the risk, because this imposes a requirement that they offer, that an insurer participating in Oregon offers a bronze and a silver in and outside of the exchange. I would have thought that the risk, I would have thought we're less worried about whether they'd offer these more affordable plans that are more likely to draw the lower risk, and that, in fact, our maybe our policy concern will be, will they offer a higher coverage plan with less cost sharing, that's more like a gold platinum version? I guess I would have thought that might be one risk we'd try to address with this bill, but it's not. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I think you bring up a good point, because I think this is just one piece of that selection issue. Remember, the federal government's requiring three strategies. One is a reinsurance mechanism very similar to Senate Bill 514 that you passed out of your committee that looks at where are the unhealthy lives going, and those that have healthy lives will be subsidizing those carriers that have unhealthy lives. More unhealthy lives will probably go to the gold plans, and they go to the bronze plans. And there are two other strategies they have. One is a risk corridor, and one is a kind of a risk adjustment mechanism they have. I believe we're going to have a fourth mechanism that is going to be more Oregon specific. Once we see the plan design or the design of the exchange, we actually have authority for the exchange board to come forward and propose a fourth mechanism if we feel it's needed beyond what this bill would provide and beyond what the federal government provides. So you're right on. Okay. This is just a piece of it.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else?
Rocky,
is it going to be short? Because we need to get Rep. Kotek in. Okay.
What are the consequences of not doing this? Very short answer.
Representative Thompson, Representative Greenlick, I think that we'll have a plan out there, the CHI plan, the basic plan, that is irrelevant and doesn't mean anything and may not be sold. This will give us some plans that actually people are going to enroll in and give us across exchange for both the individual and the small group. Remember, the CHI plan is small group only. This would apply to both the individual, where we're going to see the greatest growth in this state, as well as the small group plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 91. We will not be working this bill today, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 97A, and in the wings we have the illustrious Representative Kotek waiting, I understand. Okay. Who, as with all representatives and senators, needs to be somewhere else almost immediately, right?
I think you're waiting for Senator Mona Sanderson, too. But
yeah. I think so. But
you can stall long enough.
I'll stall. I'll talk about it. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Good to see you all again. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick. Senate Bill 97A is a bill that passed the Senate, now in your possession, that deals with cultural competency training for all of our licensed health care providers. It's a really important bill. Been following its progress on the Senate side. They've been working very hard to craft a bill that could be managed within the fiscal constraints of a lot of licensing boards. Why it's important for me is during the interim, the Oregon Health Policy Board did in-depth work, as you know, creating Oregon's Action Plan for Health, outlining a strategy for achieving the triple aim, whether we all agree the triple aim makes sense or not, but the triple aim, as it were. But one of the eight strategies was to improve health equity. We have got to make progress on reducing health disparities. We have to understand that Oregon's population is becoming increasingly diverse. 39% of the Oregon Health Plan population identifies as non-white. Improving health equity is absolutely necessary to improve health outcomes and drive down costs. We're talking about making sure when a person goes in to see a provider, that provider knows how to meet that person where they are, culturally, linguistically, ethnically, because we do not want to have barriers to communication for someone to get the appropriate type and quality of health care. Senate Bill 97A implements one of the Oregon Health Policy Board's strategies for achieving health equity by ensuring that health care providers receive ongoing training in cultural competence. Senate Bill 97A defines cultural competency and requires the Oregon Health Authority to work with the necessary regulatory boards to create cultural competency curriculum in concert with national efforts. The timelines in this bill are very reasonable. The goals are absolutely needed, and I hope that you'll be able to consider this bill and move it along to the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, and my colleague is here. So thank
Senator
you.
Mona Sanderson, we're Good very
afternoon.
Pleased to see you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson, representing Gresham, Trout, Deadwood Village, and Fairview. I'm sorry I missed her testimony. I hope not to repeat it. But
we did that on purpose because we didn't want you to coordinate your story.
All right.
So
well,
we
are a very diverse population. And I feel so strongly that research shows that there are health inequities in populations that experience mental illness, disabilities, and within sexual minority communities. A large body of published research shows significant race-based inequities in access to routine medical procedures, cardiac medication, coronary artery bypass, dialysis and kidney transplantation, quality of basic clinical services and intensive care, even when the variations in factors such as insurance status, income, age, and comorbid conditions and symptoms expression were taken into account. So we have to have a health system that meets the needs of all Oregonians, no matter what minority status they have. And the bill does direct the Oregon Health Authority to develop standards. The nurses want it, the physicians want it, but we don't have boards that can take the time to look at what should the standards be. And the Oregon Health Authority can do that. All cultures, economic statuses, races, ethnic backgrounds, disabilities, religions, genders, and sexual orientation. Licensing boards don't have the time to do this, and they don't have the expertise either, but they want to have this information to share with their licensed professionals. And this, I feel, is a very key element of the legislation. The Office of Multicultural Health and Services in the Oregon Health Authority will develop the standards. They will do the literature search. They will gather the information. And then if a licensing board doesn't have to, but if a licensing board wants to consider offering to their licensees the opportunity to educate themselves, they then will have the information to do it. It's not a mandate to any licensing board to implement any rules for their licensees on continuing education for minority status. And it does not require participation in continuing education and cultural competency. But if the licensing boards do decide to do this, then they will have the information, research-based, outcome-based, to develop these requirements. It's really going to then, this piece of legislation is also going to allow the state of Oregon to receive funds from other sources. And I think this is critical also. It could be federal funds. It could be private foundation dollars. This bill would allow the health authority to move that funding to the licensing boards and other entities for implementation of cultural competence continuing education. So, colleagues, we really do have to address the variety of health disparities that exist among our very, very diverse population. And our world is ever shrinking. America is a country of many races and cultures, and we should celebrate and embrace our diversity. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 97. Thank you.
Any questions for our first panel? What a complacent committee today.
Compliance.
It's not Friday.
Compliance. I feel like it's Friday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a lot of people to testify today. I would ask that you keep your testimony concise. If someone before you has made the point that you're about to make, you don't have to do it again. And we will proceed with Tricia Tillman, Simeon Mamerill, and Jamie Bash. Please begin.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlight, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the House Health Committee. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Multicultural Health and Services in the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 97A, and actually I want to thank Representative Kotek and Senator Monis Anderson. I don't have a lot more to add because they've covered it so well. As you know, the state has been grappling for a long time with the issue of health inequities, well documented by race and ethnicity, and data emerges to show that we need to look at the issue of health inequities from other perspectives as well. So looking at mental health, disabilities, geographically isolated communities, and other culturally defined communities. These inequities will present a significant challenge to Oregon achieving our triple aim. It's very hard to achieve that goal of appropriate access to health care, better health outcomes, and controlling costs if we don't resolve the issue of health inequities. These inequities have been documented for a long time throughout the country and within the state of Oregon. This conversation's been happening for over a decade, starting with the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force convened by Governor John Kitzhaber in 1999. And the evidence abounds, and I'm happy to share with you any of that information if you would like additional details. Along with the documentation of inequities through the data, discussions about how to reduce or eliminate these inequities have been occurring simultaneously. We haven't seen as much action as is needed, really, to turn them around. The Oregon Health Fund Board in 2009 and the Oregon Health Policy Board in 2010, along with the Institute of Medicine in 2003, have recommended a number of strategies to address health inequities, including assuring a culturally competent workforce in order to reduce barriers to care, improve quality of care, promote health, and prevent disease. And at the same time, as Representative Kotek mentioned, Oregon is becoming more diverse. She talked about the population of Medicaid recipients, but in general, in Oregon, 20 years ago, one in 10 people in the state of Oregon identified as non-white, and today that's one in five. And for children under the age of 18, one in three is a person of color. So Oregon is changing. And the diversity within Oregon is changing, so the need for constant updating of those dynamics of cultural competence is important. So the populations that have been coming to Oregon over the past 20 years might look different in the next 20 years, so it's not a one-time issue. The Senate Bill 97A reflects a very collaborative process. The definition was included at the request of Senator Cruz, and it would continue to support collaboration between the Oregon Health Authority, health professional licensing boards, and stakeholders who represent the diversity of communities impacted by health inequities. It lays a foundation for an effective and coordinated strategy to improve cultural competence in the healthcare system. So today we ask you to join with an increasing number of Oregonians and other healthcare experts across the country to provide the active leadership needed to allow for this collaborative development of a system for promoting a culturally competent healthcare workforce and an implementation plan of action that can be codified into law. And in doing so, you'll be putting into motion one well-documented strategy that will help Oregon eliminate health inequities. Truly implement patient-centered primary health care and come another step closer to achieving that triple aim. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. I think we'll hold our questions until we have all three of them. Jamie, are you next?
Yes. Hi, I'm Jamie Bash. I'm representing the Oregon Center for Christian Values today. Chairs Greenleck and Thompson, members of the committee, thanks for allowing us to meet with you today. I come from a Christian organization, so we look at this through a values lens, and we care very much about ensuring that all people, regardless of their background, their culture, et cetera, receive health care. We believe that we should care for the sick. And when we see statistics like blacks having a 20% more likelihood of having a safety incident when they visit a healthcare establishment. That screams that there's probably some issues and some injustices in our systems in regards to providing health care to people. And when we look at these minorities, some of the barriers that they face include responses and practices by healthcare providers that were inappropriate to relative objective characteristics, meaning color, immigration status, language, insurance costs. It can cause patient-provider misunderstandings based on perceptions and expectations of illness, treatment, and care, and can result in inappropriate care and can be based on provider prejudices or stereotypes. Looking at this again through a values base, at least the AMA and the APHA Code of Ethics support this kind of work. I suspect other codes of ethics in the healthcare sector would support it as well. And I do want to reiterate that cultures are dynamic and they evolve over time. And so we shouldn't forget that there are groups beyond just racial and ethnic minorities that experience cultural barriers. We've had a huge shift in technology, so our elderly also have cultural issues. If you look at how young generations communicate with their doctors versus older generations, they're quite different. And so I ask and encourage you to ensure that you are looking at cultural competency with a very broad lens. And I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Simeon.
Good afternoon. Simeon Mamaril is my name. A Filipino-American citizen, chairman of the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs, and I'm involved in various organizations state-wide and also out of state. I am a member of the Council of Filipino Organizations consisting of 14 Filipino organizations throughout the state. I'm the chairman of the board of the Philippine-American Chamber of Commerce. I'm also the secretary of the Federation of Philippine Chambers of Commerce nationwide, and also in the Family Center and under ERCO, and the American Pacific, Asian Pacific American Seniors Coalition. So I also represent the seniors group. Well, I am here today seeking your support and approval of Senate Bill 97. Dealing on culturally competent care of various of our various constituents. As a background, we are a people of color, more specifically coming from various regions. From the Far East, there are 3 countries. From Southeast Asia, there are 7 or a couple also, including those from the Indian continent and the former Soviet Union countries. These Asian Pacific communities, American communities, are much an integral part of our present-day society, and a fast-growing one. We are reportedly having 32 different ethnic groups with 500 languages and dialects. And we have the largest population in this earth. Having these statistics and informations in mind, indeed, there are attendant large disparities among us in terms of social, economic, health, education, among others. Yes, of course, characteristic when we deal in numbers. The trend of growth in numbers is unstoppable, and the associated attendant problems in daily life, no doubt, automatically goes along with them too. And the main issue in this forum today deals particularly on health. Because of this wide disparity, no common ground, no one solution is quite feasible in dealing with personal and or individual problems, especially on health. Because of the aforementioned diversities and visible disparities, not only in terms of each group of ethnicity, but going down to each individual, for medical provider giving the necessary solutions to their needs, would indeed be enormous. Hence the need of a trained, professionally, culturally knowledgeable provider to be able to answer and deal effectively relative to health problems. Otherwise, the care given would be ineffective, wasteful, worthless in some ways. This unnecessary outcome of care given would otherwise be effective and successful if only there is a common understanding through a better communication between and among parties involved. Again, this ongoing problem is not only, if not only to avoid waste and achieve a better result in handling on health cases among our constituents, a continuing educational training among our medical providers on culturally competency that will promote and or result to quality and affordable care. Yes, training is a condition, should be a condition to licensing, if only they could be more efficient in handling specifically individual cases brought before them. In any person-to-person dealing, common understanding is a key issue, and that good communication between the provider and the patient is of great importance, resulting to better solutions that will no doubt be feasible health-wise. To achieve this health-wise scenario, Senate Bill 97 would indeed be the answer. Thank you, sirs, and hopefully you will support Senate Bill 97, which aims to have culturally competent health care that would be efficient and effective, not wasteful, under a medical team of physicians, nurses, and such other medical practitioners duly trained for this purpose of giving such medical care and assistance. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I do have a couple questions. I've heard both in my office, I've had at least four appointments on this bill, but also some of the testimony around costs, that this is going to save money. And I guess nobody's been able to really articulate where they think those direct savings are going to come from if we institute the savings. And then the other piece, and actually I have a laundry list here, but the other piece that kind of ties to this is there's some expectation that there's going to be savings, but then this notion of what the expected outcomes really are going to be for a volunteer bill that we're going to potentially expend some dollars on, a volunteer bill, and then we're in a class that, you know, might be a couple hours, once a year, once a biennium, what the real true expectation is. I mean, we all sit through some of those classes, I think, sometimes. I'm pretty sure we have one in the legislature that really we all sat through it, and I don't believe that anybody paid much attention to it. Where we do this perfunctory, it feels good on the surface kind of stuff, but it doesn't really get to the root problem, and I'm just not clear after four appointments in my office with folks how this bill solves what you're trying to get at.
Chair Thompson, Representative Parrish, thank you very much for your question. So there was a couple questions
there,
one about the cost savings and the other about outcomes. What do we really expect from this? In terms of the savings, one of the main issues around the cost savings is that when providers are interacting with patients but not addressing the issues of culture, there's a potential gap in communication, which could result in not accurately understanding the symptoms, not being able to communicate what the issues are around what the cause is of the health problem. So in some cases, people might think about health in our healthcare system from a biomedical model, right? There's an infection and a disease, and then there's a cure. Where in some cultures, health issues might be understood from a sense of balance, being out of balance, or from a spiritual perspective. And so if the provider is spending time with a patient talking about one particular understanding of health, but the patient isn't there in that conversation with them, that is an issue of time, the cost of the provider's time when they order tests based on what the patient says are their symptoms. If they're ordering tests that are not the right tests to order, that's a cost. So it's really about addressing waste, duplication of services based on poor information, providing prescriptions or recommendations for what the patient needs to do to improve their health outcomes. But if the patient isn't hearing that or understanding that, then they're going to come back again if the issue isn't treated. It could be that people are using the emergency room as their first provider because they don't know how to navigate the system because it hasn't been explained to them. Some folks are coming from countries where the healthcare system looks very different, and so they don't necessarily know how to access our healthcare system. So many issues where that poor communication across cultures actually results in poor outcomes, which cost money to treat later, waste, which of course costs money, potentially medical errors, which could cost significant amounts of money to the healthcare system. The way that we have structured this piece of legislation does not actually result in a specific class. What it results in is a conversation between the professional, the healthcare professional associations, the licensing boards, the Oregon Health Authority, and community-based organizations to develop the system of continuing education. So that could mean assessing and evaluating web-based trainings which already exist and have been certified by national organizations and are currently being utilized across the country. It could mean actual classes in person, but it could be, it's more than a I'm okay, you're okay kind of training, but really looking at, you know, what is the nature of health disparities? What are the cultural value orientations? And, you know, what are some communication skills or ways to kind of unearth that there might be some communication gaps happening. But it also could mean something like service learning opportunity for providers to actually engage with communities of color on their turf to understand their culture. So providing services at, for example, a community-based organization that serves a specific cultural population to learn from them about culture, or it could mean something like language immersion, which some people are pursuing anyway, but they might not be getting any kind of credit or seeing how to tie it specifically to their practice. So I think there's a number of ways to get there. This group that we would pull together would help to make sure that we're meeting the needs of rural providers, providers with specific specialties, as well as the different learning needs or styles, and make it the most effective and accessible for a number of healthcare providers. So I hope I've answered your question.
Please.
Well, I guess, okay, I'm gonna try and go really slowly with this, because I'm still kind of concerned that we're putting the onus on a physician or a phlebotomist or a pharmacist or anybody who's got an IFS after the last name who does medicine, that we're putting that onus on them and not on the individual to articulate their needs. So you mentioned particularly around like going to the emergency room. I mean, are they going to the emergency room because they don't have insurance? I was told in a meeting that I had in my office with someone, they're going to the emergency room, and they might actually have insurance, and because the doctor doesn't do the right thing by them. And I'm like, well, where's the personal responsibility to change doctors if your doctor's awful? And, you know, and how, if you've got somebody who's potentially racist or they don't care, they're perceived as not caring, that this actually gets to and solves that. And the other piece of, I guess, my concern is that, as I understand it, you know, going through the training, and I've talked to some medical folks that I know, that they actually do get quite a bit of this in college in their programs in terms of ethics and patient care and bedside manner. And what is the reasonable expectation for a doctor, say, in Portland, who's dealing with somebody with 45 different languages? Look at Portland Public Schools dealing with, you know, 45, 50 languages. What is the reasonable expectation for a doctor or a care provider to actually do this? And I guess, you know, I've got a little bit of personal history in this, and so I'm trying to just get at how this is really going to get you where you want to go, when I'm not solidly convinced right now that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, would you like to?
Well, I'll just give you a stark example. I have a relative who is diabetic, and I think the diagnosis is one of his legs should be cut. But what was cut was the other leg. So it was because of miscommunication, perhaps, or there was no understanding or clear message, or between parties, the doctor, the provider, and the patient itself, or members of the family who represented this relative of mine. So that shows that there should be training among these providers because of the varied diversities and disparities that we are having from our side.
Representative Parrish, can I jump in as well?
Sure, I'm going to follow up again, but go ahead, jump
okay.
in.
Okay, so I am part of the majority here in the U.S., aside from being a woman, I'm white. So the white category puts me in the majority, but I've been on the flip side. I have a minor, or my bachelor's degree is in international relations, and that took me to Honduras to study for 6 months in a rural region of Honduras. And I kind of got to see what the differences are in healthcare, that unless you're exposed to different cultures in these kind of firsthand learning experiences, it doesn't fully click. So the clinic that I worked at saw a lot of women, and there was one female doctor and one male doctor. And I got to sit in on some of the examinations with the female doctor, and I kept noticing that our female patients would not refer. They kept referring to the part. The part hurts. The part, is swollen. What is this part that they're speaking of? She's like, well, women won't refer to their anatomy specifically because of some cultural restrictions. And so you can't expect a doctor to know that about every culture, but as an international relations person, I do understand that it's possible to set up frameworks for people to understand where these miscommunications can occur, and to identify situations in which they should be paying more attention. And so I do, just from firsthand observation, I can tell you that there are opportunities where, a little more training will reveal these areas to improve diagnoses. And then I've also been a patient abroad as well. I have epilepsy. My husband doesn't speak Spanish. I do. Had a seizure, knocked my head in the in a museum in Spain, and my husband was whisked off in the ambulance with me to a hospital with no way to explain what had happened, no one there to walk him through the system. And, maybe part of our cultural competency training is letting our doctors know what language services are available and who to call when they can't have that conversation directly with their patients. So just some more tangible experiences to help you visualize why this is important.
One more.
Well, I guess the thing you're talking about, somebody gets their leg cut off and it's the wrong leg, I think that's a malpractice thing and not necessarily a cultural thing. And just for full disclosure, I am a first-generation American. I am half Middle Eastern. My brother is half Mexican, and my stepfather is African American. So I get this, and I've taken the little grandma who doesn't speak any English to the doctor. And my concern here really stems from where is the onus on somebody who comes and they have some of those barriers to also assimilate. And I watched this, and God bless the doctors who took care of my grandma, because she, until the day she died, refused to learn a word of English. And it was very frustrating for every doctor who dealt with her. And I don't know that a class could have solved that problem. And she was obnoxious to them, and she was frustrated because she didn't speak the language, and yet there was no onus, no personal responsibility for her to ever give up Arabic and actually try to communicate with these doctors. And they were dealing with her for cataracts and for diabetes and for every issue under the sun, and finally, heart failure. I struggle that this and the expenditure of the money is going to get us where we want to go. So, and I won't take up any more time, but I'm struggling with this bill a lot on a personal basis.
Can I respond, Coach Thompson? So I agree with you that the issue of cultural competence and health inequities is a very complex issue. Cultural competence continuing education is one strategy. It's not the only strategy. There is a measure of patient responsibility to engage effectively with the healthcare system, and I think that some of the work around coordinated care organizations is moving us in that direction. Health systems are moving towards better patient health literacy, which should also help with that. This bill specifically deals with the one strategy that focuses on continuing education for healthcare providers. In the bill, it doesn't say what the expectations are for providers or how far this will go. That would be the work of the collective that this bill would establish. So with healthcare providers, with the licensing boards, with the provider associations, and with communities who are paying their dollars, tax dollars, into a healthcare system that should also be accountable to their needs, that sense of what the reasonable expectations are, the quality standards, and what the expected outcomes would all be developed. So I think the opportunity is this is one bill, one approach, but it's the one systematic look at one strategy to address health inequities in the state of Oregon in this legislative session.
Trish, the people who have come to my office, and there have been quite a number on this bill, have all dealt with issues of nationality, racial, linguistic things. Does cultural, as it's used in this bill, also apply to sexual orientation?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it does. Sexual orientation, disability, geography, okay. Yeah, age, all of those things, and I think you'll be hearing more
okay.
from some of those folks.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you bringing this forward because, you know, again, also having a bachelor with a concentration in international studies, I've had to receive health care abroad and have dealt with different immigrant populations and health disparities here in the U.S. But the point about cultural and regional differences is we all the time in this committee deal with the difference between access for rural residents versus urban residents and expectations. And I think, you know, when we look at this is about racial differences, difference in sexual orientation, but also really strong differences in how to approach pregnancy prevention in Eastern Oregon and versus in downtown Portland. So I think this is important, and I'm glad you brought up the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. And next we'll bring Yvette Maranowski, Aaron Reed, and B.J. Kavner. And while they're coming up, let me kind of remind you that we don't have to go too far into this. What this bill does is it authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to actually set up a mechanism to study and do something about this. So, you know, we don't have to go into huge detail of everything that's wrong. That's why we're doing this, so we can correct that. So if that helps you give your testimony. I'm going to have to limit people to 3 minutes now. We're running far afield here, and we'll be here till 9 o'clock tonight. So if you please keep your comments to less than 3 minutes. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Yvette Maranowski, and I am a member of Oregon Action. I am here asking for competency in disability. I do have post-traumatic stress disorder from the family law system, and in that experience, one of my earliest PTSD nightmares was where I was basically living with my daughter inside of a grave in the ground, and at up above it was a park-like setting. At the end of a grassy path, there was like an iconic like White House figure with the white columns and so forth in the sunshine. Okay, that was a little nightmare. It doesn't have to make sense to anybody. But then 5 years later, I was speaking with a well-known lawyer in Portland who spends time in the courtroom, and he told me that the courts were actually designed to bury people. And anyway, a few years before that even, I had been told that I had indications of PTSD by a healthcare worker. And but no one followed up with me. And as it turned out, my trigger was actually bureaucracy and red tape and those kind of things that I experienced, because that reminded me of the court system. And so consequently, I couldn't deal with that kind of thing at all, period. And so what the outcome of this was that there was a 10-year delay in my getting the disability that I needed. And during that time, I raised a daughter who is now accepted at Reed. She's going to be attending in the fall. But in the meantime, we lived in extreme poverty. And she's going to Reed now with extreme fear of poverty. And that might affect her outcome at school. And I'm really, you know, it's not over yet. And what I wanted to say, sorry, it might need more study with PTSD. I get sick of hearing myself speak about it, but since I'm here, I need to say that PTSD is a cultural thing that gets passed on through the generations. And that's absolutely true. There's been a lot written about that. And furthermore, I read a book about a lady who led a program at college where they were counseling rape victims, and the counselors all developed signs of PTSD for rape and the fears of being in, you know, dark alleys or whatever. And, you know, so it is something I think that deserves more attention, and I'm just bringing it up, you know. And then as far as the healthcare costs, there I have some things to say. During the basic 10 years that I didn't have disability, I was under a lot of stress, and the stress for me was at such a level that if something happened that
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up pretty
okay.
quickly.
Okay. Okay. There was at least two times that a stressful event happened, and I got extreme severe bronchitis, like, you know, within like a week of the event. And beyond that, even I can't tell you how many times I actually had my hip that would go out of joint, and it would stay out for like 3 months at a time because of stress. And that was completely unnecessary. And as I remind you, you know, we don't even know what's going on with my daughter now, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Reed, and I'm from Portland, here representing the LGBTQ Health Coalition of the Columbia Willamette. Thank you for this opportunity to express our support of Senate Bill 97. The LGBTQ Health Coalition of the Columbia Willamette is a community-based coalition of agencies in the Portland metro area working together to achieve health equity for gay and transgender Oregonians. We envision that all LGBTQ persons thrive in an inclusive society where laws, policies, and systems support wellness. For this reason, we support Senate Bill 97. Like many minority groups we stand in solidarity with here today on Senate Bill 97, health outcomes for LGBTQ individuals are negatively impacted by lack of cultural competency by healthcare providers in a variety of ways. The same experiences that other minority groups report, such as lack of effective communication between patients and providers, distrust and fear due to lack of culturally specific knowledge by healthcare providers, and lack of access to services because of these barriers, hold true for LGBTQ individuals as well. For many LGBTQ people, fear of coming out to healthcare providers and a general lack of knowledge around gay and transgender specific health issues prevents them from accessing vital services, particularly primary care and prevention services. Transgender people especially report high rates of refusal of care by healthcare providers, and many are even physically or verbally harassed in healthcare settings. In a recent survey of LGBTQ individuals in the Portland metro area, almost 1 in 10 respondents said they couldn't get needed healthcare in the past year because they feared discrimination. Even more, transgender individuals were 3 times more likely than their non-transgendered counterparts to avoid needed health care because they feared discrimination by a health care provider. These barriers result in poor health outcomes for LGBTQ individuals, in addition to higher health care costs for everyone due to lack of preventive services and an increased likelihood of utilizing emergency room visits and a greater propensity to experience chronic diseases. The implementation of the amended version of Senate Bill 97 is a key step for achieving health equity for all Oregonians. The LGBTQ Health Coalition of the Columbia Willamette is happy to facilitate any necessary training or refer any of the already available resources to the Oregon Health Authority to ensure that, if passed, resources that are LGBTQ culturally competent are easy to access. I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Right on time. Excellent.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlick and members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is BJ Kavanaugh. I'm the Public Policy Coordinator for Cascade AIDS Project in Portland. Cascade AIDS Project is the largest AIDS service organization in Oregon. We just celebrated our 25th year anniversary. And I'd like to speak today about our reasons for supporting Senate Bill 97A. In addition to the battles that people face with healthcare issues, people face another battle with regard to HIV/AIDS, and that's stigma. The stigma associated with those who have the disease, the misinformation associated with the knowledge of how the disease is transmitted, and et cetera. To address Representative Parrish's comments, if I may, one of the ways that we can address this is by talking about sexual health and the issues of sexual health and cost savings in there. If we have providers that are able to understand and patients that are able to communicate with their providers the specifics of their life, then providers will hopefully be able to help patients make better decisions for their sexual health. A cost savings that we could look at is by avoiding an HIV infection, a patient is going to avoid $15,000 a year in medical costs from just HIV medications alone. And that's an annual cost that keeps going up each year. And if I may remind you, many people living with HIV are unfortunately also using public health funds, and so that's a benefit that we all pay. Cultural competency is important not only for improving communications between patients and providers with sexual health, but with all health. It is essential for assuring quality health care, as outlined in the triple aims. It's essential for helping people understand what medications need to be taken, when, and how. This is something that if you ask anyone who is a pharmacy technician or a pharmacist, they will see again and again, people simply do not take their medication on time as directed because they simply don't understand it. And this goes beyond being able to deliver the same information in a different language, but being able to deliver the information in a way that a patient is going to understand and then be able to communicate with their provider. Continuing education in Oregon through healthcare providers can be web-based, as Latricia Tillman stated earlier, and or provided in group settings. Cascade AIDS Project does this work now through the work that we do in community settings, volunteer, and we're happy to provide HIV 101 trainings to anybody who welcomes it or needs it throughout the state. Again, we're leading the nation in the technology that we are doing with health information technology and also with information in general. So I feel that this is an idea and an area where Oregon can excel and lead the nation. And finally, cultural competency trainings need to be addressing the specific issues of Oregon's populations, not just limited to race and culture, but economic stability, including technological understanding, gender, and sexual orientation. I thank you very much for this opportunity to address you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Right on time. Perfect. Any questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And next, I'm going to show my cultural incompetence here because I can't pronounce half these names. But Lillian, is it Tsai?
Yeah.
Okay, good guess. Sandra Hernandez and Nicole Lucero. Oh, okay. We'll go with two, and then we'll bring up yours, okay?
Okay, good afternoon, Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlick, I guess, who's not here.
My name is Lillian Tsai.
I should say, a number of people have other committees they have to testify in. So if you see people get up and leave abruptly, it doesn't mean they don't care about what you're talking about. It just means they have to be someplace else.
I understand.
So, okay.
And members of the committee, my name is Lillian Tsai. I'm a Malaysian Chinese immigrant, and I'm here to urge your support of Senate Bill 97. I'm also a small business owner specializing in, guess what, cross-cultural competency, consulting and training, and a member of the Asian-American Pacific Network of Oregon, APANO, which is a grassroots civil rights, social justice organization. What I wanted to say has already been said. You heard about the diversity of our population growing. I wanted to skip in my testimony to a couple of more points. SB 97 is a modest plan to develop cultural competency standards in education collaboratively between experts, providers, and regulatory boards in order to improve the way our health system delivers care. SB 97 is simply good business. It drives quality and equitable care, which ultimately lowers costly mixed diagnosis or improper treatment. This is good for Oregon. It's good for our hard-working citizens. And cultural competency is about interacting effectively with people of different backgrounds. Given that this is what I teach, this topic is near and dear to me. And it's not just because it's my work, it is also my passion. Over the last several years of doing this work, I've been consulting with many healthcare organizations. And what surprised me was the majority of them were not yet culturally competent from how service providers interact internally within their own staff of color to how patients are diagnosed, screened, or treated. So this is an issue that's definitely in the top of my mind. When healthcare professionals lack important critical information or understanding of the health and cultural background of a patient, we all pay for it. As we heard, ineffective patient communication and understanding leads to misdiagnosis, treatment, and is a driver of health inequities. A report released by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies conducted by researchers at Johns Hopkins University and the University of Maryland shows that between 2003 and 2006, the expenses linked to health inequities for communities of color cost more than $229 billion U.S. dollars. That's a lot of rice. Add the indirect costs. Couldn't help that. Add the indirect costs for lost days and reduced productivity, and the total cost for health inequities came to $1.24 trillion nationally. Unfortunately, in Oregon, there is no such definitive study yet. However, we know that in our communities, there exist stories of individuals, as you've heard, who have suffered due to inadequate cultural competency, and we know that the most likely reason people go bankrupt in Oregon is medically related. As our communities are growing more diverse, it is important that we understand that we have an opportunity now to do something about it by passing Senate Bill 97. APANO is happy to share and introduce you to more stories like this, and we urge your support for the bill. And by the way, cultural competency starts here with all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Thompson and Greenleg and committee members. My name is Nicole Lucero, and I'm here today on behalf of my classmates currently enrolled in a new Master's of Public Health course at OHSU Genomics and Public Health Policy to provide testimony on SB 97. During one of our sessions, actually, Senator Moniz Anderson spoke with us about the bill as part of our work on social epidemiology and healthcare disparities. So, as mentioned, in light of the growing diversity in Oregon, enforcing the requirement for healthcare professionals to gain cultural competencies is vitally important in all areas of healthcare. But specifically, we would like to address the necessity for cultural sensitivity when using genomics and P4 medicine in clinical practice. So, as you may know, genomics is basically the study of the entire human genome, including not only the actions of single genes, but also the interactions of multiple genes with each other in the environment. P4 medicine refers to the idea that biotechnology can influence medicine and create a system that is predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory, managing health instead of treating disease. So without culturally appropriate patient clinician communication, the use of genomics in clinical practice has the potential to amplify current health disparities in healthcare. There's an increasing demand for healthcare personnel who can explain the risks and benefits of these aspects of healthcare to patients, but in order to convey genomic information effectively to patients and families, healthcare providers need to understand the cultural values of each of their patients and anticipate how these values will influence the way in which patients, families, and communities will interpret and act on this information. Professional humility that is less authoritarian and respects the patient's agenda and perspective will bridge the cultural poverty and ethnic gap, providing more effective communication about complex medical decision-making. Encouraging healthcare providers to know about cultural issues that create healthcare disparities ensures that every race, gender, and socioeconomic background will be able to benefit from the future of personalized medicine. To make best use of the genomic data, it will be essential for clinicians to be able to educate their patients about the beneficial applications of genomics, as well as its limitations within the context of cultural concerns. Together, such measures may help to reduce health disparities in health. Social progression as a result of the translation of genomic discoveries to the practice of personalized medicine for everyone will be what we want it to be, and now is the time to make our case. With the passage of Oregon's SB 97, Oregon will have the opportunity to be at the leading edge of cultural competency in the practice of healthcare in the United States. On behalf of my student colleagues and our instructors, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share these perspectives with you today.
Thank you. Right on time. Okay, we're going to depart from the schedule because we're going to lose some people, and I'm going to temporarily close this public hearing and open a public hearing on, open a work session, oh, I screw that up, open a work session on Senate Bill 99A. So thank you for your testimony. We'll be back to this bill shortly. So work session on 99A is now open.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Amendment A14 to Senate Bill 99A, and let me take the motion. I'll just comment on it if I may.
Okay. Co-Chair Greenlick has moved Amendment
A14
be adopted for Senate Bill 99A.
We're not going to be able to move Senate Bill 99A today, but I did want to work this amendment, if it's okay with the committee, to get it ready so we can then get whatever paperwork we need. If I can comment on the Dash 14 amendments, it represents a compromise to several of the issues that we've been talking about. And basically what this does is it deletes one sentence from two places in the bill. And it deletes a sentence from page 9 of the bill. That's on line 14 through 16. The sentence that starts, the corporation may limit. And the same sentence in the next section of the bill, in section 4. And what this does is it takes out restrictions on the work plan for the exchange board. The exchange board needs to have its work plan to us in February. The bill keeps it relatively open. This is the section we heard a lot of testimony about that prohibits the bill from the exchange work plan from negotiating for price. This simply opens it up so that the exchange board can produce whatever work plan it needs to produce to us for approval in February. So it takes away the last of the preconceived notions about what needs to be in that work plan. I have indications it's acceptable to the Senate. It doesn't tinker with the makeup of the board. It doesn't also tinker with my interest on agents. Back off this, but if we accept this and
move the bill off the floor and to the Senate. I have indications it will be acceptable to them, and it can move forward. So I ask for an aye vote on this one, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think I'm going to support this, but I would also put on the record a caution. It is my intention to see this bill move forward with as few encumbrances as possible so that in the interim we can do the planning work to perfect a work plan for where we want to go. That will come back to the legislature in February for approval or not. I have questions about a number of these issues, and I trust that between now and February, the work group on this will get all of the issues resolved to my satisfaction, which that was a joke, by the way. But I reserve the right to vote against the work proposal when it comes up in February. But I think it's reasonable to give the health authority as much rope as possible as they go into their planning. So the worst thing that we could possibly do is write a business plan for this project and then give it to them and tell them to bring it back to us in February for approval. So what I think this will accomplish is we will leave things very, very open as we move forward, allow them in an unfettered fashion to produce a business plan, and then we'll have the hassle about whether it meets our requirements or not. So I would, if you don't have a whole lot of amendments beyond that one, I think I would not have a problem. Representative Cannon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the work of the co-chairs to get to this point on the Dash 14s, and I will support them. I would say I don't think they go far enough, and I did ask for a Dash 15 to be prepared. I think members have it. I'm not planning on making a motion on it, but it would actually require the exchange corporation to, within their plan, plan for using their leverage to reduce costs. And I think, you know, we're going to spend $48 million or whatever of mostly federal dollars to put this exchange together. I think, gosh darn it, better be more than a fancy website. This cannot simply be a purchasing tool for consumers. There are different mechanisms that I hope we get to reduce costs through an exchange, including through pooling for individuals and small groups, including some of the standards related to essential benefits plans and cost sharing. But I do believe that this notion that the exchange would actually use those, you know, thousands of lives to drive a better deal with insurance companies ought to be up front and center. And I'm disappointed that that will not be explicit in what we're handing to the exchange corporation. But I understand the sort of political rationale that we're going to be dealing with this again in February. Let's not tie their hands. Let's not take anything off the table. I'll support the Dash 14s on that premise.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. My position is I want to know whether or not the planners need the ability to negotiate price in order to make this go. You know, on the flip side is I don't know if they don't need it, in which case I'm looking for the plan to come back and justify to me they've gone one way or the other and why they did that and why the other one was not desirable, so that we can have a real weighing of the information and hopefully get a good plan that the legislature can support. But I think right now caution is probably a good position for us to pursue. And looking at the very cautious look on Representative Parrish's face, we will go to her.
I guess I don't feel really comfortable moving any amendments forward, not just this one, until we see everything that's going to hit this side. I don't know that these kind of one-off, let's take a piece of this, and now even here there's maybe a Dash 15. And I'd rather see all of those, truthfully, line them up, have everything that's going to come before this committee amendment-wise, and not just one-off, keep changing and tinkering this thing. I'm for that reason, I'm not going to support an amendment today, because I really think that everything needs to be all cards on the table so we can make good safe decisions about what this thing looks like going forward. Just to keep saying, well, here's another one and here's another one, you know, I'm worried about that. So, and it has nothing to do with this particular amendment as it is. I just don't think we should move forward on amendments until we have them all, look at them all, and then make the decision how we move forward. Because, you know, the next amendment that comes forward could fundamentally change what we're accepting right now. And I just, it's kind of a time suck in some ways to not have all the full information on the table to make those decisions. So,
in general, I agree with you. But I also am aware that there's the potential for about 35 amendments to pop up on this, which really doesn't set the stage. It curtails development along a very narrow channel. In a conversation I had with people from the Health Authority on Friday, I made it very, very clear that I think it would not be in their best interest to take this bill, if we were to approve it, go home until February and come back and spring something on us. The correct line of action will be to work very closely with us and other legislators through the next 6 months or so and massage out a work plan that is going to be acceptable in February, in which case you should have a lot of opportunity to continue this discussion. What I see this bill is doing is allowing them to proceed and cautiously. They still have to have approval of what's going to happen.
Mr. Chair, can we recess for a minute, please?
Stand at ease.
Stand at ease.
Yeah. Stand at
Thank you for your patience. We will reconvene the House Healthcare meeting for Monday, May 9, 2011. We are in a work session on Senate Bill 99A.
Mr. Chair.
And there have been some late developments. As you might expect, that could happen. Mr. Co-Chair.
I withdraw the motion on the A14 amendment.
Co-Chair Greenlee withdraws the request for the A14 amendment on the Senate Bill 99A. And I will therefore close the work session on Senate Bill 99A. Done.
Public
now hearing. We'll go back to the public hearing on Senate Bill 97A.
I'll be right back, Jim.
Okay. And question?
No, my bill's up in Senate Healthcare.
Oh, yes. No, I understand some of you have to leave. So
yeah.
That's why we're trying to get 99 in before, because I knew you weren't going to be here.
But so we could not vote on 99 in case I wasn't
here. Well, we did establish that we're not going to vote on 99,
perfect.
So now you can leave, okay?
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. We want Sandra Hernandez, Hina Harris, and Maria Antonia Sanchez.
You did good in the name.
Thank you for your patience.
No, you did very good in the very well in the name. Thank
well,
you.
I had a cheat sheet. Please state your name first,
yeah.
And you may proceed.
The co-chairs, Thompson and Greenlee, and all the members of the committee. My name is Sandra Hernandez. And I'm the director of the Tree Institute, and I am one of the Tree Institute is one of the organizations that forms CHARLA, Collective Health Advocacy for Rooted Latinos and Africans, which is also members of POCHEC, People of Color Health Equity Collaborative, a statewide collaborative of people of colors. We actually are not going to really say much more than anything else. We would like to have two of our colleagues giving some of their stories to share, to support our support to the Senate Bill 97A. Just a couple of thoughts that I myself like to compliment from everything we have heard already today and what we have been actually studying and learning and, you know, teaching each other and exchanging some information. One thing is, it's very important. We have here a colleague from Hood River, and CHARLA and POCHEC both are committed really to do more research and find out information, everything that we can, you know, for our own understanding and for sharing with, you know, all of us when we are crying and looking, proposing things like the Senate Bill 97. And one of the, for instance, something that we found out recently that was kind of astonishing that the people from Hood River was asking me, but that's not exactly what is going on here from, you know, the county health report cards. It is stated that Hood River is the healthiest county. And that might be true, but the thing is really about when we're talking about cultures, the difference of cultures, and for Latino communities, especially there, we know the disparities are much bigger and is not really revealed there. So that's one of the things that we are working and looking to find more information and share. And also to say that through this bill, we really have been finding ways to discuss of how cultural competency is a two-way process. When we say, yes, we seek to share with the Office of Multicultural Health Services the way that we normally do working with our communities using theater, for instance. We do public forum theaters. That's another strategy besides this bill. How can we learn and discuss and openly bring our thoughts and, you know, from the community, and also learning how can we develop our own capacity from your culture here as well. So that's part of the process. And now from there, I'd like to have Kina and then Donna Toyan talking. Thank you.
Hi, Kina Harris, and I would like to read a story from an African youth in Portland. His friend, who had recently arrived from Congo and spoke Swahili, came to stay with him. Eventually, his friend felt a strong stomach pain and almost lost consciousness. Desperate, he called 911 for an ambulance. When the ambulance arrived and his friend heard it and saw the paramedic coming for him, he reacted against it and did not want to enter the ambulance. In the African communities, when an ambulance comes to your home, it is because the person is about to die. And the emergency personnel could not understand that.
My name is Maria Antonia Sanchez, or Toña. Either way. I'm going to tell you a short story, but a painful story for me. My nephew, a newborn with some sort of sickness, was diagnosed with to die or live in 72 hours. And the doctors arranged to have a meeting. I make a decision to go with my niece to the hospital because of the gravity of the baby's life. While waiting for the doctors, the nurse started discussing with a translator who was from Spain and spoke different sort of dialect, Tanas, about the baby's health situation, leaving my niece out of the conversation. I was helping my niece to understand what they were saying. They got upset with me, and when the doctor arrived, they want me to leave the room. I did not. When I realized that they were not respecting my niece's presence and the importance of the baby's life, who is her own son. In our communities and culture, mommy and baby are one and must be treated together always. To separate them is not okay.
Thank you so much for
thank you. Any questions for this panel?
No.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Dave Fiskum.
And I think this is Kesa.
And Kesa Jarma, maybe?
Jarma.
He had to leave and felt his point.
Okay.
And then Ty.
Schwarferman.
Okay.
Please begin.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dave Fiskum, for the record here for Providence Health and Services. As you may know, Providence operates 8 hospitals around this state with a number of special programs, including an insurance plan, Providence Elder Place, as well as then Providence Child Center. Let me just digress briefly and thank you very much for the informational hearing last week on the Child Center. The Child Center much appreciated your attention to their presentation and the issues they face. And so thank you, Mr. Chair, very much for your courtesy in that regard. Beyond that, I'm here to give you a letter, which you'll be glad to know I will not read, in the spirit that you all can read it for yourself. It's a letter from James Mason, our Regional Director of Diversity Initiatives, and he makes a number of points worth noting in that brief one-page letter. In addition to being consistent with our mission and core values, this legislation upholds one of Providence's foundational beliefs that health services be provided in a manner that respects the dignity of every patient, and I emphasize the word every. With that, Mr. Chair, I will allow you to read his letter. We wanted to go on record in favor of Senate Bill 97, and we would urge your consideration of this bill in a favorable fashion, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair and members of the committee. I will not waste any of your time. My name's
never a waste of our time.
My name is Ty Schwefferman. I'm with the Urban League of Portland and also with the People of Color Health Equity Collaborative, and we are in support of this bill. I only have three copies of a document that is National Perspectives on Cultural Competency and Continued Education, some research that has been done, including a local researcher at Oregon State University. So if you would feel compelled to read through some of these research documents, I'll make them available for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Parrish.
For Dave, so is Providence not already doing this, and you need a law to make, get you going the right direction, or?
Can you repeat that question?
So is Providence already not already doing this? I've actually delivered a couple babies there. You're not already doing what this is prescribing, or and you need us to hold your hand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, I'm tempted to tell you that I've never been in the maternity ward for the reason you have, but that's probably obvious. Providence does have a strong record of being interested in diversity. As part of this goal, Providence, as you see in paragraph 3, has developed cultural competency curriculums and diversity resources for our employees. We already are involved in this in a variety of ways. We've offered our resources to the state for purposes of this bill were it to pass, as being one resource they could turn to for this commitment, which is in sync with our sense of mission. So, Lieutenant Parrish, we already are involved in this very genuinely, and would and believe that this bill would move the state forward in a direction which requires, I would say to you, personal commitments as well as corporate commitments to make sure cultural diversity and competency training goes forward in a reasonable fashion. So thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe that concludes everyone we had down to testify on this bill today. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 97A. And is there any objection to working this bill today?
No.
Okay, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 97A. And Representative Cannon, I under vice co-chair, whatever the codes, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor. I move Senate Bill 97A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Co-Chair Cannon has moved Senate Bill 97A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And it looks like Representative Doherty has some.
And just very briefly, when you look at cultural competency, and I think it's way overdue in the medical profession, because this is something in education we've been doing for 20, 30, 40 years with the different diverse populations that come through the public schools. And I think it is so imperative to have this kind of program in the setting, because we've got so many of our students that unfortunately have had to act as translators for their parents, which is sometimes very awkward in a medical situation. But it's not only that, but it's also some of the folk medicine that's in culture that we identified as, some people would have looked at it as child abuse, but in the cultures, especially in the East, in Vietnamese cultures, quinine and that kind of thing was considered part of folk medicine. So it was through that sort of thing that really helped at least the educators go through and understand some of the cultural diversities when it came to that, and I highly recommend this. It's way overdue. There's some facilities that are doing it, but places like Providence can always, work with other institutions and make the program even better. So I'm highly supportive of it.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'm not going to support this bill today, and for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, I think I've expressed, I don't know that this gets us where we want to go. It came to us, and I don't know if this is going to Ways and Means. I mean, but I was told there was some limited fiscal impact, and I had a couple of folks come to my office, and they say, well, it just has a limited fiscal impact. I'm like, yeah, so do 3,000 other bills this session. And when I'm faced with the decision of starting a new program versus looking at, the senior community, for example, who's about to kind of lose programs and staff and things in their center as we're making cuts, one, I don't think this bill, again, somebody who's experienced 20 years of taking grandma to the doctor, I don't think this bill gets us where we want to go, but can we justify a new expense, new program, in a time when we're making significant cuts to human services and everything else, fiscally responsible, I can't get there from here and support this. But I appreciate the people who brought it forward because I think it does merit a conversation. I just don't think this bill actually gets them where they want to go.
Don't believe we entered the fiscal statement on the record, did we?
No, Mr. Chair, but I believe it's on the S drive, but we have the fiscal statement from the Senate side that says it's a minimal expenditure impact to the government entities that it impacts.
Okay.
But it also has that footnote, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that while the individual measure has a minimal impact, an agency may incur a net fiscal impact greater than the minimal, depending on the cumulative impact. So.
That's convoluted.
Well, the mortuary board might not have quite the problem that the...
Any questions, comments? Quickly?
I'll drag this out so Representative Hoyle has to stick around longer, but I think this could have some undue impacts on other departments as well, so I won't be supporting the bill today as well. But the committee wants to move it. I feel free to go ahead and move it. But I think it probably should visit Ways and Means and be looked at a little closer. So,
no more comment? You call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative
Whitehair?
No.
Vice Chair
Cannon? Aye.
Vice Chair
Cannon? Aye.
Co-Chair Freeman?
Excused.
Co-Chair
Thompson? Aye. With that, we have the votes to pass this measure.
And who's going to carry
it? And who would like to carry this?
Rep. Kotek.
Rep. Kotek would like to carry this, I'm certain.
That would be wonderful.
We'll be back to one of you if she doesn't. So. Okay? Is there any other business before the committee today?
Nope.
Hearing none, I will adjourn the House Healthcare Committee for Monday, May 9th, 2011. Thank you all for attending.